KCRW sponsors include Make It Universal and Rotten Tomatoes, presenting Scene on the Screen with Jacqueline Coley, a new podcast about the people at NBC Universal and the movies that define them. Available wherever you listen to your favorite podcasts.
From KCRW in Santa Monica, this is The Treatment.
Welcome to The Treatment, which you can also hear at KCRW.com. My guest, Renaissance man James Andrew Miller, has written about several institutions that are basically men's clubs in transition. His book on the Senate Running in Place dealt with his time there. He also did the amazing bestseller Live from New York about being in the halls of Studio 8H for Saturday Night Live. His newest book, also written with Tom Shales, is Those Guys Have All the Fun, A Look at ESPN. Jim, first of all, thanks so much for being here.
Thanks for having me.
But that's the thing that does fascinate me about these books you've done. They are about these men's clubs. They start off as being basically the province of guys who are incredibly competitive in places that you wouldn't expect competition. And then we started to see these shifts, certainly more so in Live from New York, and Those Guys Have All the Fun than any of the other books. But that's amazing to me, though.
It's interesting you say that. I hadn't really thought about that, although there were two female senators when I was working in the Senate and the time, the period that the book covers. And I definitely think that at that time, the Senate still was very much a men's club. John Belushi on Saturday Night Live used to say he wouldn't do sketches that were written by women. So there was certainly difficulties for women in that environment, although it's gotten better through the years. And of course, with ESPN, over the 32-year history of ESPN, there have been some challenging times, some brutal times, and then some better times for women. So I definitely think the gender issue is alive and well in all three.
But it's something that kind of attracts you. And these are also places you kind of had personal and or professional relationships with. I just wonder if you had a particular point of view that offered you a chance to look at that and examine it, because the other books written on these places never dealt with those kinds of things, really.
I think that one of the things that was intriguing, particularly how it manifests itself with Saturday Night Live, was just how extraordinary the measures that the females had to go, the lengths that they had to go in order to be recognized and to feel worthwhile, so to speak. I mean, Gilda Radner, who, obviously during her time at Saturday Night Live was our Lucille Ball. I mean, she was wonderful and celebrated and so brilliant. But unfortunately, she had died before I got a chance to interview her. But the truth is, I spoke to so many people who talked about her, rampant insecurity.
Her bulimia.
Her insecurity. And, she was always worried about whether Lauren liked her. That need for approval and that feeling that, she didn't belong, or that feeling that she, needed to know how she stood all the time. I mean, clearly the guys who were around at that time were not thinking that. So it's extraordinary. It's more difficult actually with ESPN, because you're dealing there with a larger corporate structure and levels of management. And there's not this one person like there is with Saturday Night Live, Lauren, where you can kind of get, you worry about him, but also if Lauren smiles at you in the hall, then, your blood pressure gets lowered. It's much more of a kind of a Wizard of Oz thing with ESPN.
I mean, and the thing I think that also links the Senate and Saturday Night Live and ESPN is they're basically these magnets for ambition. And the thing you expect that in the Senate, of course, but you wouldn't expect it at Saturday Night Live or ESPN. I mean, those of us watching from the outside.
Right. Although I do think that if you replace, look, there are ambitious people at all three places. Less so with Saturday Night Live, because there's some, just the typical writers who are getting stoned and stuff like that. It's not like they're trying to be driven.
But the point being on SNL was you want to get a sketch on the air. I mean, that right. was always the ambition. Whatever people had to do to sort of do that, they would try to do.
Right. But here's the thing that's extraordinary about ESPN. If you think about your high school class and you think about, the most aggressive, outspoken sports fan that you knew, there's probably, even to it doesn't even matter how big your high school class was. There's probably like two or three people that you could think of. Well, Bristol is made up of an entire town of that. All of those 6,000 employees that work, that's who they are. They've come from those. It's like those two or three big alpha people from your high school have come together and to form a company. So it's like one of the producers said to me, and it really made an impression on me early on when I was working on the book. She looked at me as a woman, actually, and she said, "Jim, if you've never cried when your team lost, you have no business being here." And she means it. I mean, so these people are incredibly ambitious, but also they're incredibly competitive because competition is the very essence of sport. And so they kind of take that and it to their daily work. It is a very high-charged environment.
It's the treatment. I'm talking to Jim Miller about his book, Those Guys Have All the Fun, a look at over 30 years of ESPN at this point. But I guess what I found to be so interesting about the plays is just that, you, as you say in the book, it becomes a biosphere. I mean, it's this place where – but I said to you before we got started, it's like a MASH unit where there are no patients. So people basically have all this energy to use them. And it even reading the book reminded me of the movie MASH. I mean, right down to the sort of the sexual escapades and the, sort of the bullying that took place. And that was the analogy that came to me.
Yeah, no, I think that's very instructive. I think that, you know, the funny thing is that you are kind of crashing, so to speak. That it's not helicopters coming with wounded patients, but it's games coming in. And there's games and there's games and there's games. There's 65 sports. There's an endless tsunami of activity. And so what happens is, you know, the place is in a perpetual state of activity. And it's not just like the 5 minutes leading up to a sports center. You know, they have, I mean, in recent years particularly, ESPN now controls over 50% of live sporting product in the United States. That's an incredible share of product. And when you think about what that means, just in terms of not only their financial might, but in terms of their influence over sport, it's incredible. So you have all these people doing this work in this very high-charged environment. And that's why you get some good stories out of it.
You got a bunch of great ones. And the thing you remind a lot of people of, which I think many of us have forgotten, that ESPN became a power without the NFL.
Yeah, I mean, it turns out that the NFL is really the ultimate, pardon the expression, game changer. Because up until 1987, ESPN was, you know, moving along. They had the America's Cup, which actually turned out to be quite important for them, the NCAA basketball tournament, and a variety of other things. But when they get half a season...
But the draft, I mean, it was having the NFL draft.
The NFL draft was certainly a great moment.
And talk about that story, I mean, about them getting that draft and people basically saying, nobody's going to want to watch this.
Right. Well, this was Chet Simmons, you know, looking and saying, how are we going to fill this up 24/7? And also recognizing that perhaps the only way that infant ESPN could get aligned with the mighty NFL was to cover this thing that basically nobody paid attention to. Indeed, when Chet Simmons went to NFL Commissioner Pete Rozelle, Rozelle said to him, "Are you crazy?" You know, because he said, "I want to televise it." He goes, "Are you crazy? Why is anybody going to watch?" And by the way, you know, if you go to Radio City Music Hall now, 31 years later, like I did this past year and the year before, you know, it's such a huge event. So Chet gets the last laugh. But the point is, though, that whether it was the draft, NCAA, America's Cup, or whatever, in 1987, when ESPN gets half of that season of the NFL, they start to become part of the club. And certainly in 1998, when they get the full season, it winds up being not only creating a different patina for the network, but also that deal, of course, is the financial engine, which fundamentally alters the entire financial model of ESPN.
But even you mentioned in that great section of the book when Chet Simmons is talking about that. By the way, you should remind or let listeners know who Chet Simmons was.
Yes, he was a former executive at ABC and NBC, and then he was the first president of ESPN. He got there in 1979.
And what was incredible about that moment is he recognized that just having the NFL logo on the air basically gave them the imprimatur of respectability.
Absolutely. It was like last week at the ESPYs, I was trying to, you know, move next to Justin Bieber to get some clout with my daughter. You know, if you're that, if you get that close to something great, you know, you get a lot of attention. I did not manage to get that picture, but it would have meant a lot. I would have definitely scored a lot of points with her.
Well, that's probably the end of public radio. Justin Bieber and great in the same sentence. It's a treatment. My guess is Jim Miller.
How did we get from the NFL to Justin Bieber? I'm terrified.
Just think about that's right. You're bringing this place, this institution down. We're talking about his book. Some those guys have all the fun. His book on ESPN. But you mentioned the ESPYs, and there's a. Which becomes kind of an interesting threat throughout the book because there are those supporters, then there are those people like Bill Maher saying in the book, we know who the best teams are. They've won. Why do they need an award?
Yeah, people have very strong opinions about the ESPYs. I will say this, though, going back to our earlier comments about women. The executive producer of the ESPYs is a woman named Maher Mant, and I'm trying to think if there's a woman at ESPN or associated with ESPN who has the kind of stature or impact that she does. I mean, obviously there's some great female executives, but who work there. But she is really a force of nature. Sorry, pardon the cliche. And I think that if nothing else, even if you were to hate the show and hate what it stands for and hate all the fashion and everything else, you have to admire the fact that she basically wills this thing together. She has, a very connected group that she works with, and she wills this thing on the air every year. It's particularly fascinating to watch.
But you also let readers know, too, that there's a woman who very early on was instrumental in basically helping the whole This Is SportsCenter ad campaign come into light. And that's Harriet Seidler.
Harriet Seidler is an unsung hero. She is working for Oprah now. And the truth is she wasn't there long, but she did like two key things. First of all, she was very important for her that Wieden and Kennedy, the advertising company that did the This Is SportsCenter campaign, become part of the mix. And the second thing is I think Harriet understood the notion of promotion in a fundamentally different way. She came from MTV, as did her boss at the time, John Lack. But I think that there could have been a lot of people in her position as a senior VP of marketing who wouldn't have really had the vision that she did and the ability to work with Wieden and Kennedy to get that launched.
And the other unsung hero, which you just sort of mentioned, was Bristol, Connecticut. And for those who haven't read the book, tell them what that place was and what it came to be.
Well, the headline is this. It's very simple. If ESPN was just yet another network that was housed in Manhattan, I'm not so sure we're talking about it right now. That's how far I would go. There were a variety of key success factors that Bristol brought along with it, and I'll just quickly mention a couple. First of all, it was a non-union shop. So early on, ESPN management was able to talk about indentured servitude. These young people were working like 18 hours a day, just getting pummeled without union protection. So they got a lot for a little. The second thing is, even though they had a series of corporate owners through the years, nobody wanted to go to Bristol. So it wasn't like, these people were coming and walking the hallways and policing things. So they had a great degree of autonomy. Another thing was that if you're working in Bristol, it's not like NBC or CBS either knows about you, or if they try and steal you away, your kids are already settled in Bristol. It's a big move to move to New York City. So people basically, and I've said this before, but people don't date ESPN, they marry it. And in part because you're just kind of, in this cocoon of Connecticut that you don't want to leave. You kind of get used to it. And so those three things really wind up having, a huge impact. It's also, you're not influenced by what's going on in Manhattan. You're kind of like doing your own thing. It was a geographic cable mindset that was unlike anything that was going on in Manhattan at the broadcast networks.
We'll take a break. We're talking about ESPN with my guest, Jim Miller, and his book, which is Those Guys Have All the Fun. I'm Elvis Mitchell. It's The Treatment. There's more to come.
You're listening to The Treatment with Elvis Mitchell from the studios of KCRW Santa Monica.
Welcome back. It's The Treatment, which you can also hear at KCRW.com. We're talking sports for once, thank God. My guest is Jim Miller. He's the co-author of the book, Those Guys Have All the Fun, a look at ESPN over its over 30 years of being on the air. We were talking before the break about, well, this is SportsCenter, and that phrase and its genesis is basically a kind of an ironic comment on the kind of strictures that attempted to be placed on Keith Olbermann and Dan Patrick is an interesting story, too.
Yes, because Keith and Dan were fond of calling their 11 o'clock Sports Center show The Big Show, which did not please management because they felt like they were doing something that wasn't about the network, that they weren't paying enough respect to SportsCenter. You know, the title of SportsCenter, there was also resentment from the people who were doing the earlier show because they thought that their show was like, by saying The Big Show, that was like the most important show. And so Keith, you know, in a very heated discussion with management said, what do you want us to just say? This is SportsCenter? And of course, they said yes. And then Keith went to town on it saying, this is SportsCenter. You're watching Sport. You know, he kind of like buried them in it, and it became a running joke. But sure enough, it was used for, you know, one of the most successful promo campaigns of all time.
Well, how do you attribute that move from ESPN literally being a place you could say log rolling in hard time because there was log rolling events on ESPN to now the it's not even ironic anymore when it's called the worldwide leader in sports. You talked about Bristol being a part of that. But for you, what was it? I mean, what made you want to do this book?
I think that I looked at something that was so huge. It is all over the world. It is, you know, probably, you know, one of the great media success stories of all time. So I kept on coming back to this question. How did this happen? You know, and what the book tries to do is it tries to trace the pedigree of ESPN through these 32 years and also identify some of the key moments. There's actually 9 in the book right now that speak to, they were, you know, fundamentally.
And you basically make it about eras for each of these moments have happened.
Right, right. But they're also special events, just like, you know, ESPN getting football or, you know, even the very first one, which was this notion of buying a transponder on Satcom 1, which made them a cable entity. Without these 9 things, I think that the company is not even anywhere near what it is today. And so that was the real ambition of the book, was to kind of chronicle, you know, to give people who watch ESPN a sense of not only how it started, but how it became what it is today.
But the fascinating thing about this, too, and to me it links to the Saturday Night Live book, is that you wrote about 2 things that became institutions by virtue of the fact there was this hunger for both that nobody ever bothered to address before. I mean, looking back, it sort of seems like they were a fait accompli. But now, I mean, now it looks like that, but you look back, you kind of go, wow. So it didn't occur to anybody, given that if you, at a certain point, if you were home on a Saturday afternoon, you were watching White World of Sports or on Sunday Grandstand on NBC, and you just wanted something like that. And that seems to be something that fascinates you, too, these sort of moments that coalesce in the culture and become institutions.
Yeah, I mean, I think that with ESPN in particular, I mean, forget about the fact that Rasmussen had shown the business plan, the original business plan for ESPN, to 7 investors, and they all turned it down, and the 8th was Getty. And if Getty hadn't come up with the money, I don't think it would be around today.
By the way, they went for Getty, and if there hadn't been a blizzard, then the place would have been shut down.
Well, it wouldn't have been in Bristol, right? but even as recently as 1990, there was 20% of this company that was up for grabs, and there's Warren Buffett talking to Cap City saying, no, don't do it. I mean, people didn't really understand it. And so, you know, yes, it's very easy to sit back now and say, oh my gosh, they're doing over $8 billion in revenue. Oh, you know, oh my gosh, yes, this is a no-brainer. But, you know, people did not realize it. And by the way, it's not like NBC or CBS saw what ESPN was doing in the 1980s and said, wait a second, you know, let us vertically integrate. Let's get one of these cable entities of our own, because here's the thing. If you take a 4th grade classroom and you say, okay, kids, here we go. There's this cable network called ESPN, and they get their money from cable systems and advertisers. And then over here,
ESPN started that, by the way, basically. Right.
And over here is a broadcast network. Let's call it NBC Sports. They only get their money from advertisers. Okay, kids, raise your hand if you think ESPN's going to win. I mean, the fourth graders are going to figure it out. So, you know, while NBC is to be applauded for MSNBC and CNBC, you know, and all the creations of these other platforms, it's not like they were all of a sudden paying attention in the 80s or the early 90s and saying, wait a second, we got to do this too.
Well, the only person who really, I'm sorry, we should say it's the treatment, my guess, is Jim Miller. We're getting all heated up about ESPN because of his terrific new book, Those Guys Have All the Fun. But it went from seeing basically ESPN being this marginal thing to almost during the merger with ABC being thought of as a way to supplant ABC Sports, which there wouldn't be any ESPN without ABC Sports.
Well, no one saw that coming, though. The truth is that ABC Sports and ESPN, I mean, I could have written a whole book on that because it's such a dysfunctional marriage, in part because it starts out with ESPN basically begging ABC Sports guys for cables and them saying, forget it, we're not going to even give you a cable, even though they were owned by the same family or at least a major investor. And then they kind of achieve a certain kind of parity, but then all too quickly, the mouse just kicks the lion's butt, and ESPN, in effect, closes ABC Sports. There is no ABC Sports. And I think that for a lot of people who were at ABC Sports through the years, and even some transplants from ABC to Sports to ESPN, that was a particularly painful thing to watch. This was the house that Roone built, basically Roone Arledge, being decimated by a cable entity.
And it's funny because you can't, again, going back to Wide World of Sports, that microcosm of trying to and basically encapsulate the world of sports into an hour. Without Roone Arledge's creation of that, there wouldn't be an ESPN.
Right. Well, I come back to this quote that Tech Schramm said to one of the head Getty guy when he was trying to figure out whether or not to invest in ESPN. He went to Tech Schramm, the president of the Dallas Cowboys, and Tech said, there's no way that this idea will work because people won't watch sports 24 hours a day. And what he failed to realize was ESPN wasn't about watching sports 24 hours a day. It was about making sports available 24 hours a day. And that is the big change. So what you're talking about is exactly right. It means that you don't have to wait for Saturday afternoon, the CBS Sports Spectacular or you know, Grandstand or something else. It's always there for you.
And also that thing that Roone did with starting with Howard Cosell and a few other people is bringing in people with a point of view. You think about the big successes of ESPN and whether you like Jim Rome or not, he brought a point of view to the network, and that was one of the things responsible for its success too, finally, was it not?
Yes, but I'm constantly amazed by the balancing act because in a way there's all these kind of ironies or paradoxes at work with ESPN like that. For instance, they don't really like creating stars.
In fact, that's the stated policy. There would be no stars.
They really don't like making stars. But then again, they give Colin Cowherd and Jim Rome and all the great vehicles. And so they have enormous followings.
Is arguably the biggest person in sports broadcasting Chris Berman?
I'm not so sure now.
But there was a point, you know what I mean?
Oh, yeah, absolutely.
He was the definition of the network in the late 80s through the mid-90s.
Yeah,
thought of ESPN, he thought of Chris Berman.
Absolutely, absolutely. And I think that, you know, although he's a little, you know, once they got past Berman, I think that was part of what Keith and Dan ran up against because they didn't want anybody else becoming as big as Berman. When you become that big, you have to be paid a lot of money, and you also ask for special favors, and it's a whole litany of things that wind up being just a huge pain in the ass for management. So it's much easier to have, with all due respect, interchangeable parts. I mean, the truth is ESPN now, when you think about it, ESPN is in a position of such power that if you're a talent, a piece of talent at ESPN, unless you're maybe one of maybe less than two handfuls of people, you have absolutely no bargaining position, because who else is going to hire you now? There are no jobs. There's no money. I mean, yes, there's NBC Sports and CBS Sports and Versus, but then I mean, it's not going to be like the competition like it used to be. So they have a lot of people over a barrel.
It's the treatment we're talking about. People under a barrel, the folks at ESPN. My guess is Jim Miller, his terrific new book is Those Guys Have All the Fun. But the most fascinating thing to me, finally, is that two of the biggest people ever to come out of ESPN, Robin Roberts and Keith Olbermann, and they end up in news.
The two people with kind of incredibly different temperaments. One was basically, you know, the wind that propelled the ship, and the other was the rudder that kept the ship steady. What do you attribute their successes outside of ESPN?
Well, I think, you know, look, both are very talented, and both...
But again, wildly different personalities.
Yes, but I think that, you know, you look at the canvas of you know, television news today, there's a lot of different personalities. There's certainly room for both of them. I think that I think it says more about ESPN that both of them were able to flourish at that time. Robin was part of the earlier Sports Center with Bob Lee and Charlie Steiner, and when Keith was doing his show with Dan at 11.
But they basically have the disadvantage of not even having a lot, as you mentioned in the book, not even having a lot of the scores available yet for the early Sports Center.
The early Sports Center was much harder than the later show. But I think that Keith and Robin are proof that, you know, if you, and Brian Gumbel made the transition too from sports to news. I think if you're good at what you do, and you're smart, you can make the transition. We're watching Josh Elliott do it now. He left ESPN last year, and now he's the newsreader at Good Morning America.
But it's interesting, too, because I'm glad you brought up Brian Gumbel, because there's something I know we've talked about as friends in the past, that thing where, you know, for African-Americans often to succeed, you have to come from another perch. And for both Roberts and Gumbel, it was coming from sports. And you don't often see other people having to sort of prove themselves in that way. I mean, most of the people who come through the morning news shows have come through a kind of a traditional path and kind of picked. These people were outside successes in other worlds before they were brought into the news department.
Right. I'm not sure. I mean, maybe I'm missing. I'm not sure about the racial component to it, only because there have been a lot of other people who have made it. But I will
but
say
I'm
just this.
For the racial, I mean, for the black people who succeeded, they've come from those areas.
Absolutely. I agree. And I do think, look, Bryant, when Bryant did it, there was a lot of doubters. He clearly had to prove himself. And even after he proved himself, I would say he still had to prove himself, which is something that a lot of people didn't have to go through. So I give Bryant a lot of credit. I mean, he's great in sports, and I think he was very good on the Today Show.
Well, but it's fascinating, too, that finally the Sports Center has now become, it almost feels like this other institution itself. I mean, outside of ESPN, I mean, it feels like to some extent it's as big as the network is, if not bigger.
I don't get SportsCenter now because I get it. I watch it, but my point is,
that used to have is gone, isn't it?
We get everything on our phone. We get the highlights on the web. I keep on coming back to this idea that they really need to cast SportsCenters. It should be like watching The Daily Show or, you know, Letterman or something. We need those Keith and Dan couplings like before. Right now, there's this random rotation of people coming and going. And so I think that part of what SportsCenter's value proposition should be to viewers is not only going to give you the highlights and the analysis and everything else, but you're going to hang out with these two people. And these two people are going to be there every single day or every single night, and you're going to like them and want to keep coming back for more. I think that that's something that they really need to do.
Well, the man emphatically banging his hands on the table is James Andrew Miller. His book is Those Guys Have All the Fun, A Look at ESPN. Jim, thanks so much for being here.
Hey, thanks for having me.
Our recording engineer at Argo Studios in New York is Paul Ruess. The show is mixed and edited by J.C. Swadek. This is The Treatment. I'm Elvis Mitchell.
An audio archive of this and other programs can be found at kcrw.com. The Treatment is produced and distributed by KCRW Santa Monica.
KCRW sponsors include Make It Universal and Rotten Tomatoes, presenting Scene on the Screen with Jacqueline Coley, a new podcast about the people at NBC Universal and the movies that define them. Available wherever you listen to your favorite podcasts.